Consider that since 1979, more than 62,000 people have been killed here in El Salvador, and more than 7,000 have disappeared. Also, in the United States, there are nearly 1 million Salvadoran refugees.
Since the early 1980s, the armed forces have carried out intense bombing in the countryside. Hundreds of thousands of campesinos have been forced to flee their homes. I am here in the U.S. because I had to leave El Salvador. Because I was a union member, I was captured by the army and held in jail for 2.5 years. While I was in jail, my mother was murdered. So you can see that through the repression, they not only split up families, but they kill people within families as well. In response to the killings and disappearances, organizations have formed to demand that the government stop the repression.
We look at El Salvador from the inside, from the point of view of the people who are being repressed by the government, by presenting a moving and informative documentary on the subject, right now on Alternative Views. The people of El Salvador have been suffering terribly under the American-supported government. Tortures, beatings, mass bombings, deportations, disappearances, murder have been the order of the day for many years in that poor country. This is the focus of our program tonight, the centerpiece of which is a wonderful documentary called The People Will Not Be Silent. But before we see the documentary, here are some news stories from the Alternative Press.
A big topic during the past several weeks has been elections in different countries in the world. Of course, the Soviet election, that was the most astonishing historically. And the people in the media and television, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they were looking down their nose at these very primitive efforts of democracy in the Soviet Union. New York Times, according to The Nation, New York Times said, well, the Soviet candidates seem virtually indistinguishable, and that unconventional contenders were often filtered out. Where else does that happen? And the Washington Post said, well, the old ways persist in some districts anyway. And some of the people in the networks are saying, well, a quarter of the contest had only one candidate, so that's not democracy. Well, the Nation says, let's look back at the land of the free and home of the brave and the red, white, and blue and George Washington's progeny. Well, last year, 1988, 20% of the races for the seats in the House of Representatives were uncontested. In Louisiana, which is really a one-party state anyway, 7 of 8 House seats had one aspirant. In Texas, voters in 13 out of 27 districts had one candidate option. And more than 98% of the House members and 85% of the senators who ran for re-election in 1988 won their elections, giving Americans a collection of politicians not widely known to be unconventional contenders anyway. So, well, what about the states? Is there more complexity, more ability of people to get elected there? Well, 1986 study found that in several states, more than half the legislature races offered only one nominee, many of whom had escaped a primary. And at least the Soviets, they could vote no against an unopposed candidate. You can't even vote no for somebody who's running unopposed. And then, as John Stockwell and other people who look at the American power structure say,
the Democrats and the Republicans are just one party split in two, as Stockwell calls them, the A team and the B team. So I think maybe we should maybe not criticize these other places too much without looking at ourselves. Particularly at somebody like Nicaragua, they're always saying, oh, that communist dictatorship down there. Well, they had elections where anybody could get on the ballot without restrictions. All the candidates and parties received equal amount of money from the government. All candidates and their parties received equal amount of free time on the radio and TV stations that were government controlled.
And you had a multi-partied election then there. One of the big lies of the Reagan administration, repeated endlessly by Oliver North, Reagan, and the other thugs that were operative in that unfortunate regime, was that the Sandinistas were a totalitarian dictatorship, that they were anti-democratic, whereas the Contras were supposedly a democratic force. The El Salvador government that we supported, there, where the death squads ran rampant, was supposedly a democratic government. Over and over again, the Reagan administration just lied, you know, about Nicaragua and got away with it. A lot of the media didn't call them on it.
Because what it's interesting, it's kind of boomerang, because they're saying, okay, you got to have democratic reforms down there before we'll, you know, let the Contras go free and not supporting them. And the other South America, Central American governments, yeah, you've got to have reforms, Ortega. And so Ortega says, okay, here are our reforms. We're going to have multi-party elections. We're going to have let everybody have access to the media, equal access to the media, and we're going to give people equal amount of money. So they've already done this before.
Right.
So
there's really not much grounds to support the country.
But it makes it easy for him.
Democracy.
It makes it easy for him to make these, quote, changes because they've already been established.
Right.
Well, you see and hear all the time that, hey, we got problems with the economy. We're liable to have inflation because, horror of horrors, the unemployment rate is down to 5%. And that's the danger. We can't have all these people employed because there wouldn't be enough unemployed to put pressure to keep wages down. Now, 5% in unemployment back in the 50s and 60s would have been cause for alarm because it's way, way too high. As a matter of fact, remember the Humphrey Hawkins Act that never was able to get passed back in 1978, where 4% was the objective for full employment. Well, Lane Kirkland of the CIO, AFL, has been complaining and wrote a letter to the White House saying, hey, this 5% figure is not accurate. We've been saying that for a long time. But because the Reagan administration cooked up the figures so that it wouldn't make him look good. For instance, he ignored the growth of part-time workers. That has increased since 1980 much more rapidly than the workers as a whole. And if a part-time worker only works 1 hour a week, they are counted as employed by the Labor Department now. So this, plus other fudging of the figures, Kirkland says the unemployment figure should actually be 10%, not 5%. Well, as the people down below struggle, there are three interesting articles from Spotlight, from Dollars and Cents, and from The Guardian. The Spotlight article was referring to a Business Week magazine poll of the top company executives. For the first time in history, their average salary topped $1 million. That's just salaries. When you throw in fringe benefits, bonuses, etc., and all that stuff, the average is $2 million. And this was 354 companies and a total of 708 people. But the fascinating thing is that the top executive pay is 45 times that of a middle manager of a company, 93 times that of the average yearly wage of factory workers, 72 times that of a school teacher, and 44 times that of an engineer. Now, what makes it more interesting is that in 1960, the top executives made just 11 times more than the average school teacher. Now, it's 72 times more.
One of George Bush's 1990 budget proposals involves cutting the long-term capital gains tax from 28% to 12%. For people in the top income bracket. This would be one of the most dramatic distributions of income in which the very rich would save more money on this than any given policy of Reagan or Bush over the last 10 years. According to the Washington, D.C.-based Center on Budget and Priority Policies, Bush's proposed tax cut would further widen the gap that now stands at record levels between the wealthy and the poor, and the gap between the wealthy and the middle class. It's only the top 0.25% of the nation's taxpayers who would benefit from this would receive a 42% tax break. So this, again, would simply be another redistribution thing to benefit the rich. It's incredible the gall with which Bush wants to aid his preferred class.
Well, in dollars and cents, it takes a look at the aggregate poverty gap. That means how much money would be necessary, how much income or government transfers would be necessary to make the poor people who are in poverty rise up to where they're not in poverty anymore. Well, the Census Bureau calls this the aggregate poverty gap, and using a private sector definition of income, the aggregate poverty gap is $385 billion. Now, government transfers of different types, whether it's aid to dependent children or food stamps, whatsoever, that this reduces the amount to $239 billion that would be needed to bring everybody out of poverty. Now, could we do that? Could we afford $239 billion? Well, they're going to be pumping some estimates as high as $300 billion into the savings and loan industry over the next 30 years. Others are saying it isn't quite that much, but there are others that are saying, it, well, $239 billion? Sure. However, the article here says that amount of money could be used and could be collected by taxing away an additional 21% of the $1.15 trillion of after-tax income received by the richest 20% of the households. And of course, right now, this richest 20% receives over 50% of the income and a much higher percent of the wealth. So that'd be easy. Just have a decent tax policy and give it to us poor folk.
That's what.
Of course, I'm not considered poor. I have an income of $500 a month, and I'm not considered below the poverty line, if you can imagine that.
That's all the time we have for news right now, but we will have some more news later in the program. But now, let's see what's been happening in El Salvador with our documentary, The People Will Not Be Silent.
My life companion left to go to work. He left and he never came back. About a month later, they told me that there were three corpses in Usulutan. They had beheaded him and stripped him naked. My brothers, I have four. Two disappeared and two were murdered.
Todo esto lo hacen ellos para callarlos nuestra voz.
This is all done to try to silence us. So we gather our strength and move forward. It is our struggle, and they will not silence us. We will continue to speak out in our country and around the world against what is happening here in El Salvador.
Callarán nuestra voz. Seguiremos adelante para denunciar como nacional e internacional lo que está pasando aquí en el pueblo salvadoreño.
Most people in El Salvador historically were small farmers called campesinos, raising their own crops to feed themselves. Over the past century, El Salvador's wealthiest families have taken nearly all the best farmland from the campesinos. These wealthy landowners use their plantations to grow coffee, cotton, and sugarcane for export. Many campesinos have been forced to move to the cities because plantation wages are minimal and jobs are few. But jobs in the city are also scarce. Today, over two-thirds of the people of El Salvador are either unemployed or underemployed.
The people of El Salvador live amidst misery and death. Anywhere you walk in this city, you see it. People in misery. One could say, oh, but there's lots of commerce here. People selling things on the street. This is totally false. People are out selling on the streets so as not to die of hunger.
O sea que este es el grado de desnutrición que se da en la mayoría de niños en las diversas comunidades.
This is the result of the malnutrition that is found in most of the children in these communities. For lack of food and lack of employment. Milk is so expensive that it is hard to buy. The children are dying of malnutrition, and no one wants to concern themselves with the survival of these children. The few wealthy families who own most of the land make up an oligarchy, which controls the politics in El Salvador along with the armed forces. Many social movements have grown up in response to this glaring inequality. Over the past 10 years, hundreds of thousands of people have participated in groups working for democracy and greater equality. These groups have included campesinos, students, professionals, the Catholic Church, and urban workers.
Los movimientos laborales en este país se deben únicamente a la necesidad, al hambre, a la miseria en que vivimos.
The roots of the labor movements in this country are found in the hunger, the misery in which we live. We are struggling to improve our lives so that our children can survive and have the opportunities that only a few have had.
Beginning in 1979, the armed forces tried to crush the new political movement. One of those killed was the Roman Catholic Archbishop, Oscar Arnulfo Romero. Between 1979 and 1984, over 42,000 unarmed people were killed by the military.
Ya que en el 80 comenzó la represión en mi familia.
In 1980, the repression against my family began. On December 20th, 1980, they murdered my oldest brother. He worked in a sugar refinery and belonged to the union there. And the repression against my family continued. Now, more than 27 members of my family have been killed.
En cuanto a mi captura,
In 1984, I was captured. I was captured for being a representative of the workers and a union member. I was interrogated and tortured psychologically as well as physically.
De guerra psicológica, como usan ellos más que todo la tortura.
Y estoy aquí en Estados Unidos porque se me obligó a salir del país.
I am here in the U.S. because I had to leave El Salvador. Because I was a union member, I was captured by the army and held in jail for 2.5 years. While I was in jail, my mother was murdered. So you can see that through the repression, they not only split up families, but they kill people within families as well.
An armed resistance under the banner of the FMLN, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, grew in strength in the countryside while the military continued to kill members of the unarmed opposition. The war has continued throughout the 1980s. Since the early 1980s, the U.S. government has sent a steady flow of money to El Salvador. In 1984, the Reagan administration helped elect José Napoleón Duarte as the new Salvadoran president.
Que no les corresponde y causas en las que no creen.
No es posible comprender a un presidente hablando de paz.
I can't sympathize with a president who makes speeches about peace and at the same time is sending his ministers to the U.S. to seek new sophisticated weapons, helicopters, airplanes, more bullets. Bullets don't bring us beans or rice. They produce destruction and death.
Produce destrucción, produce muerte.
Since the early 1980s, the armed forces have carried out intense bombing in the countryside. Hundreds of thousands of campesinos have been forced to flee their homes.
We had to walk 8 to 15 days and nights, sometimes up to months. 3,000 to 4,000 people fleeing from the military who have forced us to leave our places of origin.
People have fled to cities and to refugee camps where housing and sanitation are poor.
As campesinos, we cannot make a life in the city. We don't have a place to work. Our only tool is the machete, and we can't use it here. We are used to making our own life, working the land, and we can't do that when we are locked up in a refugee camp.
The people of El Salvador in growing numbers are joining together to bring about change. One movement for change has grown up among campesinos who want to go back to their own villages. This is called the repopulation movement. It grew out of people's desperation to escape the living conditions in the city and refugee camps. An earthquake hit the capital city, San Salvador, in October of 1986 as the repopulation movement was developing. It left an estimated 200,000 people homeless, including many of the people who had moved from the countryside.
Most of the earthquake victims are displaced families, first displaced by the war and now by the earthquake. This situation is worsening, and now these displaced people are getting involved even more in the struggle to return to their places of origin.
The military tries to halt returning villagers, and once the families make it to their villages, the military often tries to keep them from staying. Repopulated villages have been bombed and have sometimes been occupied by government troops.
Dentro del ejército y los mandan en grupitos casa por casa a platicar con la señora, a platicar con
The army goes out in small groups from house to house to talk with the people. Why don't you go back to San Salvador? There the life is much easier. The humble families say to them, but sirs, we know that life. There you have to buy everything, wood, fruit. Where will we find work? How can we support our children? Our lives are in our villages, here on our land, and we want to cultivate it, to support our children through our own efforts, and no longer be sitting like parasites in a refugee camp. If they want to kill us, they can come kill us in our towns, but we will not move.
Nos van a matar aquí en nuestra comunidad, pero nosotros no nos movemos.
que en El Salvador...
Consider that since 1979, more than 62,000 people have been killed here in El Salvador, and more than 7,000 have disappeared. Also, in the United States, there are nearly 1 million Salvadoran refugees.
In response to the killings and disappearances, organizations have formed to demand that the government stop the repression. One of these organizations is Comadres, a group of mothers and relatives of people who have been murdered, kidnapped, or have officially disappeared. One prominent example of their work was in May of 1987, when Comadres immediately came to the support of three mothers whose sons had been captured.
The capture of our boys was on May 1st, 1987, after a workers' demonstration. These three mothers exhausted every legal recourse in trying to locate their sons. After the anguish of not knowing the whereabouts of our sons, but knowing who had them, the armed forces, we, the three mothers, decided to go on a hunger strike. With the support of Comadres, we went to the cathedral to start the hunger strike. On that same Saturday, we were beaten by a troop of 60 police. They wanted to get us out of the cathedral. They accused us of being part of the FMLN strategy because we were on a hunger strike demanding the freedom of our sons. Although there are witnesses to the captures of these sons, the army and the government have not been able to help or even respond. Until they have clarified what has happened to the disappeared and released the political prisoners, and until justice is brought to those who have assassinated our relatives, we won't stop marching in the streets. Labor unions have grown during the past few years as inadequate wages and poor working conditions have worsened. I am so happy to see my people struggling. This struggle is for us, the poor.
We've been on strike for 51 days. The management has responded with threats and harassment. A thousand workers have been fired. When we want to assemble, the police intervene, and as a result of that, there have been repressive confrontations between police and the workers. Unfortunately, in our country, most strikes are declared illegal as a pretext for taking repressive actions against union leaders.
Para tomar represalias contra los dirigentes de los trabajadores.
Queremos dar...
We want to explain that the workers' demands are labor-oriented, and the government's replies are always military and violent. As union leaders, our struggle is not only for those in our workplace, but a struggle of an entire nation against the suffering of our people, against the injustices of the government and the oligarchy of our country.
Despite the repression, labor organizing has grown stronger. In February of 1986, trade unionists, agricultural workers, students, religious groups, state workers, and human rights groups all came together under one organization called the UNTS, the National Union of Salvadoran Workers. One of their demands is a negotiated settlement to the war.
The birth of the UNTS was the most important event in 1986 in El Salvador. For the first time in history, our common misery brought us together. Workers, farm cooperative members, indigenous people, campesinos, state workers. The UNTS helped us to organize ourselves, and that is how we formed an organization to represent the interests of the earthquake victims. There are new groups joining the UNTS all the time, and we have organized several demonstrations to show that we are determined to fight for our goals.
Demostrando que los trabajadores estamos dispuestos a luchar para conquistar nuestras demandas.
A pesar de la situación represiva que se vive acá en nuestro país,
despite the repression in our country, we know that our struggle is just and that it gives us the strength to move forward demanding our rights, even if it involves risking our lives, so that our children will have a better future.
Estamos decididos, pues, no dar un pie atrás, incluso si es posible ofrendar nuestras vidas, con tal de dejar un buen porvenir para nuestros hijos, lo vamos a hacer.
No importan los costos.
The cost does not matter. We, the workers, will continue our struggle. There are two options. We either die of hunger or we fight. And we're going to fight.
El Salvador is now the third largest recipient of U.S. aid in the world.
Actualmente está recibiendo 2 millones de dólares diarios.
Now El Salvador receives $2 million per day from the United States government. This money comes straight from the pockets of North American taxpayers and is used to expand the war against the people of El Salvador.
Incrementar la guerra contra el pueblo en El Salvador.
We are no longer asking favors of the U.S. government. We demand that they stop sending bullets and helicopters that drop bombs on our family members who live in the country. That they send us medicine, food, which is what we need. Help for those of us who are barely surviving.
A través de las torturas, a través de los diferentes cuerpos, ya que a uno lo esconden
During my captivity at a secret military facility, I was interrogated and tortured. And while there, I realized that among the interrogators, there were North Americans.
Entre los interrogadores también hay norteamericanos.
Nosotros como madres le decimos.
We, as mothers, tell you to tell your government to get its hands out of El Salvador.
Aquí en El Salvador.
Pocas veces llega esta información hacia los norteamericanos.
Seldom does this information reach the people of the United States. You have been led to believe that it is a democratic country and that nothing is unusual there. But the truth is that every day they murder, capture, torture, and disappear the people of El Salvador.
Se asesina, se persigue, se tortura y se desaparece a los salvadoreños.
El gobierno, pues.
The government accuses us, the groups of people struggling for our human rights, of being members of the FMLN.
Nos acusa de ser miembros del FMLN.
Solamente lo que están recibiendo.
The government claims that union members are tied to the FMLN. Now Duarte sees nothing else, only the FMLN. If he's eating, he probably sees it in his plate, FMLN, because that's all he can say.
Si él quizás está comiendo, quizás en la comida está viendo el FMLN, porque solo eso tiene en la boca.
Estas implicaciones son para nosotros.
These implications are for us a danger because they can use those excuses and pretexts to take vengeful measures against us. That is why earthquake victims too are terrorized.
Por eso es que los damnificados también padecemos el terror.
La institución se ha sostenido.
Three of our co-workers from the Human Rights Commission have disappeared. Several have been captured and assassinated. Five co-workers have been jailed in the Mariona prison. They have captured members of our families.
Herbert Anaya was shot to death in October of 1987 while taking his children to school. In March of 1988, Humberto Centeno was captured and tortured. There is currently a warrant out for the arrest of Roberto Guatemala. Maria's son and the other unionists captured with him have never been found. Maria's house was blown up while she was not at home.
Nuestra lucha que tenemos no lo.
It is our struggle, and they will not silence us. We will continue to speak out in our country and around the world against what is happening here in El Salvador.
El pueblo salvadoreño.
Podrán matar un líder, pero salen dos más.
They can kill a leader, but two more will come out the next day. They don't accomplish anything by killing members of the popular movement. It just grows stronger.
Polvo sobre la abismo. Vida para salvar al Istmo nace del centro de estos días. Vida para andar el futuro nace del centro de estos días.
To me, it's utterly outrageous to see how the American establishment media have ignored what has happened in El Salvador after these elections which recently took place. The Guardian has several articles which cover what has been happening, and not to the surprise of you, if you've been watching Alternative Views, certainly not to us, after Arena was elected, well, the death squads and the repression are really out in force. As a matter of fact, the riot police and soldiers just recently, April 19th as a matter of fact, they arrested nearly 100 people during various assaults. The hardest hit was the Office of the Christian Committee for Displaced Persons, which is a national organization dedicated to aiding refugees that have been driven from their homes during the war. They came in, there were 72 people inside that were barricaded. They dragged them all out, beat them going down the street. Some of these, there were 10 pregnant women among them, 30 children, including a 3-day-old child. Didn't make a difference to the police. There were also similar attacks on labor organizations, trade union headquarters, and they imprisoned labor activists, numbering up to about 100, and many of the leaders were held and tortured. This has been going on. Particularly, it's not a surprise to people who have watched El Salvador and know the conditions down there, but to the folks up here in the United States whose, if they only saw the establishment media or read the Washington Post or the New York Times during the election, all they would think was, well, Arena is really, they've cleaned up their act, and now they're okay, they're just a moderate, they're conservative, but they're not going to abuse civil liberties. As a matter of fact, the Salvadoran candidates, both of them, hired these high-priced PR firms in New York to not only conduct their campaigns in El Salvador, but to conduct campaigns here in the United States, with the target organizations being Congress and being the rest of us, you and I, and making sure they said the right things on television here in the United States. What they didn't report was that the leading Arena strategist and vice president of the Legislative Assembly gave a speech that when they took power, it was going to be total war, and the only methods of political solution have been exhausted, and now violence is the only thing that remains. They said, by golly, the Americans dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, so now, and even the defense minister is drafting new legislation to curb any dissent, to limit popular protest and organizing, and the mayor of San Salvador is also setting up repressive measures. So, and one of them they singled out was the Catholic Church's legal aid office, which documents human rights violations. So
it's total war that they're maintaining people.
Yeah, they've been saying that for months, for years, the Arena has. That they got, they were elected, they were going to start wiping out all the commies. And who are the communists? They said, somebody asked D'Aubusson or some of the leading communists or leading right-wingers in Arena, how do you know these people are communists? How can you tell? They're just peasants or they're labor leaders. Well, if they criticize the government or if they criticize the army, then they're communists. But what's amazing is that they're still those incredible Salvadoran people, the labor people, the students and others, are still actively protesting.
Religious groups, students.
In spite of the fact that they know that they can get arrested and tortured horribly and before they're killed.
Well, this last week, we've seen a lot on the space shuttle, but we haven't heard any media reports that the federal government is drawing up contingency plans to evacuate part of Florida in October. Wow. In the case that there's an explosion and that there's deadly plutonium rains in the event that the next space shuttle launch blows up. Wow. Now, the reason for this is that NASA is moving ahead with a potentially disastrous plan to use plutonium batteries for powering research satellites to be launched in forthcoming shuttle missions. Government studies indicate that these launches will be safe in terms of the plutonium that's supposedly well cased in the spaceships, but if there was an explosion, it would shatter plutonium throughout central Florida in a region where millions of people live. Current NASA plans involve using 42 pounds of plutonium on the Galileo satellite that's going to be launched this October.
That's an enormous
amount. It's a tremendous amount, and 21 pounds of plutonium on the Ulysses satellite that's going to be launched in October of 1990. No one knows what would happen if this much plutonium exploded, but it would be potentially catastrophic. That in 1964, there was a space shuttle that burned up during reentry over the Indian Ocean and released a small amount of plutonium that they can still measure.
Oh, my God.
That this has not disintegrated. It's still providing contamination. And this would be infinitely more than any plutonium explosion that's ever taken place. And no one knows what the environmental effects of this would be.
Well, Helen Caldicott has said in the past that just a little bit of plutonium the size of pollen, if it's inhaled, will give you cancer.
Right. So this could be catastrophic. I mean, we've seen from the Challenger that these space shuttles can blow up. And if they have heavy amounts of plutonium aboard, for sure it's going to scatter throughout the environment. And what the effects will be, no one knows. But it is significant that the government is aware enough of the potential danger that they have these contingency plans to evacuate Florida in case of a
Florida.
The entire, not the entire state, but large sections of the state in the case of a space shuttle explosion.
And what's horrible is that this stuff would get in the winds and be carried
to Houston, Austin, New Orleans, and L.A.
Interesting things are happening in Peru and Bolivia. Remember, Peru had Alan Garcia, who was kind of a, well, tried to palm himself off as kind of a populist. Indeed, he actually rigged some type of special deal to get more of the oil revenues that they suspected they could get if their oil deposits were developed. And then he also took over the administration of the banks. Well, this didn't set too well back in Wall Street, so they have been boycotting Peru in the International Monetary Fund and banking family, international family, and so the sabotage has really been hurting Peru's economy. But now it seems that they have found oil out there in the jungle, and because Garcia made a deal with Armin Hammer to get it out. Well, it was tried to maintain it as a secret, but the word got out, and now the big oil companies and the U.S. State Department, of course, are now wagging their tails and trying to help out Peru. Well, because of the bad economic conditions, there have been a lot of guerrilla and insurgent activity. So the United States has sent in its assistance, of course, made up of special forces units, the expeditionary team providing drug enforcement training for Peruvian elite corps. But the main thing they're really interested in is trying to do away with any insurgency that might topple the regime that could work for the profits of the corporations, particularly the oil companies now. They've set up and trained a paramilitary anti-narcotics force known as UMOPAR, an acronym I'm sure means something or whatever, I don't know. But anyway, this is what they're doing in Peru, and a parallel thing in Bolivia, where The U.S., remember that big charade, that Gilbert and Sullivan thing, where the U.S. Army sent contingents down there into Bolivia to try to wipe out all those nasty drug traffickers? And, of course, they didn't find any drugs, but they fooled around down there for a while. But what they really were doing is setting up a U.S. Joint military base in Beni, near the along the Beni River, which is near Peru's border with Brazil. Now, they're saying they wanted to try to wipe out the drug traffickers there. Well, there are drug traffickers because that's the only thing that's caused any little bit of prosperity that's occurred in Bolivia in the past several years. But this all fits in. This and the Peruvian article. The Peruvian was in the spotlight, and this article on Bolivia's in the Nation. The Southern Command of the United States in Panama in 1987 said that it intends to use Beni as a staging point for rapid development of U.S. forces in case of insurrections. So that's why they have these people down there. They're not messing around. They're not hurting the dope trade at all. They're just there to try to prevent a repetition of the Nicaraguan and Salvadoran rebellions, which have gotten out of hand from their point of view. So anytime you see them talking about drug trafficking and interdicting that and all, they're not doing that. They're just, because they get along real well with those drug traffickers, they're just trying to keep down any rebellions or revolutions that might take place.
For our last news story, we go back to March of 1989.
Well, they made a study in Tucson, Arizona, about all the air pollution and why people were having trouble with their allergies. And then guess what headed the list as the top allergen in Tucson? Have any idea?
No idea.
Marijuana pollen. That's right. Not only that, but it looks like the marijuana is the largest cash crop in the United States. Estimated harvests evaluated anywhere between $10 billion and $33 billion. The Drug Enforcement Administration says that it's $10 billion, but that's considered quite low. And on the high end, the people from Normal, who are trying to normalize and decriminalize the use and growing of marijuana, they say it's $33 billion. Well, the reason is pretty simple. With as little as an investment of $200 to $400, you can buy a plant or two and come up with $4,000 when you sell your stuff. As a matter of fact, there was a farmer who had gone in debt and was going to be foreclosed upon. Well, he set up a few hothouses and grew some 2,000 plants, and he said, heck, if they hadn't have caught me and turned me in, I'd have been out of debt in 2 years. So, anyway, it's very interesting that there are two aspects about marijuana now. One is that it is enormous crop growing in the United States because, first of all, the outside guys don't want to do marijuana anymore, the ones that are importing it into the country, because they make much more money out of cocaine, and cocaine's smaller and it's easier to bring in. Plus, that's the CIA dope of the preference. So, anyway, the second thing is that the Drug Enforcement Administration efforts have pretty well dried up importation of marijuana. So, Americans, being enterprising folks, well, there is something like there are a few million or a few hundred thousand of local domestic growers, not even counting the people who just grow it for themselves. There was a survey made, by the way. National Institutes on Drug Abuse in 1985 said an estimated 18 million people admitted having smoked marijuana during the previous month, and another 10 million admitted using it in the last year. Now, some other organizations say that's a lot smaller than it really is, because people aren't going to admit using marijuana if the feds knock on the door and say, we're making a survey, did you use marijuana? So anyway, but this, even that small amount, translates into a demand for roughly 22 million pounds of marijuana a year. But there's another key thing about it. This article in Dollars and Cents that I'm quoting from says, marijuana is the only illegal drug that's not controlled by the cartels and the CIA or the mafia.
It also sounds like this would be a good way to eliminate the national deficit, would be to legalize marijuana and put a heavy tax on it and use that to eliminate the deficit.
Yeah.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Here are all the people who helped us with our program. We are very appreciative of each one of them, particularly Christy Swear, who is our editor. And we'd also like to thank the people who made it possible for us to show you our wonderful documentary on El Salvador. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. So that's our address if you'd like to write to us. We get very nice letters from all over the country where Alternative Views is shown. A lot of people tell us how much the program means to them. Others are requesting repetitions of certain programs they've seen, or perhaps they have other special requests. But it's always enjoyable to hear from them. So if you'd like to write to us, that's our address. Bye-bye.